Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with actor Louisa Flanagan, who is here in Sarasota as part of the ensemble company of the production of Outside Mullingar, currently running at Florida Studio Theater. Louisa is a triple threat. She sings, she dances, she acts, and she has a very long career, which started rather later than one might have assumed, given how successful she's been and how much work she's done. Listen to this interesting story. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being who you really are. As a psychotherapist, it's clear to me that many of us are demonstrating the truth about us, but it isn't the whole truth about us. In my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I talk about this as a cover story. We are demonstrating a cover story, just as a spy demonstrates a cover story, and for the same reason. Should the truth about the spy be discovered, that person would be in danger. Well, I believe that in our childhood, we decided that some truth about us needed to be hidden, and that if we exposed it or continued to demonstrate it, something that we didn't like would happen. And so we hide that quality or that way of being undercover. We create a cover story and we take that cover story out into the world. And that may work very well in our childhood, but in adulthood, some of those things that we hid away so well that we don't know we have it anymore may be just the kinds of things we really need to have the best life we can have. And so The Lynn Show is about saying it may not be too late to recover something you might have had to hide away or deny or put undercover. In my shows, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And the interview I'm playing today is with Louisa Flanagan, who is everything that she actually is. Luckily for Louisa, she had a family that encouraged her. And so she was able to discover, as it became clear to her, that dance looked good to her, that singing felt good to her. Wow, acting might be interesting. And so Louisa has had a career in the theater. It's a really interesting story from a very interesting woman. So hang on, here come the show. So I'm here with Louisa Flanagan, and I am here with Louisa because she is part of the ensemble company of the really amazing play Outside Mullingar. And I know because I saw her that she is amazing in it.
Thank you.
Oh, no, absolutely. Remarkably, everybody is amazing in it.
Oh, yeah.
I interview people who make their living or their life within art.
Oh, okay. All right, well.
And I'm making the assumption that the art to which you are mostly giving your life and...
Is theater.
Is theater.
Yes.
I really only ask one question. Do you remember the very first time in your life that dance, act, theater, performing, any of that called you, attracted you?
The ubiquitous childhood of the 1950s was to take piano lessons and go to dancing school and all of that. I was very, very blessed to have parents who could afford to do those extra things for me.
And you wanted to?
Oh, yes, I wanted to. Not so much the piano after a while, but I stuck with it. And happily now I can read music. But dance was something that I didn't like my first dancing school. She was kind of nasty, and we had to wear the tap shoes, and we sat on boxes, and then we'd stand up and dance a little bit. But my elementary school had this modern dance teacher that came in and taught modern. And it was fun. And I loved it. And my mother recognized that and found me a ballet teacher, Corinne Robertson. I loved her. She and I stayed with her all the way through high school. And she was a wonderful teacher. In my senior year of high school, of course, she let me do a solo at the year-end recital. And it was, I did it to Waltz Triste, you know, because I was leaving dance and forever. And so it was very dramatic. And my mother made me a little Grecian tunic. And I did all that because one was moving on into the quote-unquote real world to go to university.
So far, we have no acting.
Right. We don't have acting yet.
Okay. And you said you thought you were leaving dance, so apparently you didn't think you were going to be a dancer.
I had wanted to go to the Washington School of Ballet. And my dad had had a life of having to work his way through university and then through Georgetown Law and a difficult time, the depression and all of that and war. And he looked at me and he says, I'm not ever going to tell you what to do in your life, but I am going to ask one thing of you, and that is to let me give you an education.
Well, how can you say no to that?
You can't.
No, right.
You can't. And knowing what he had gone through,
right.
And of course trusting that he was older and smarter than me a bit.
And then he loved you.
Yes, and I did feel that. I did do, you know, some musicals in high school, but I was never, like, acting in the musicals. I was in the dancing chorus.
Right.
You know, because this was still the days of the dancing chorus, the singing chorus,
yes,
and the actors.
Right.
You know, so even in high school when we were doing Bringdoon, right. That's what you did. I think maybe that with the idea of a career in dance, didn't seem like it was be a way to support oneself. In the neighborhoods and stuff that I lived where there were mostly, you know, professional people and people who had expectations for their children to go into professions and things. We were surrounded by, you know, diplomats and,
right.
You know, doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs, you know, that sort of thing.
Not dancers.
Yeah. Not dancers, not painters, not artists and things. And yet, there was a great love of the arts in my family, and I was exposed to it. I mean, we were always going to the theater, the ballet, the concerts, you know, all of that sort of thing. So, and my father had quite the audiophile collection of the records and made the hi-fi system, and he listened to music constantly, everything from crazy jazz, old-time jazz to symphonies. And so there was this love of the arts there, but the idea that one could support oneself or
absolutely,
you know, was not, and that wasn't part of the program.
Okay, so where did you go to school and what did you major in?
I went to the University of Maryland. I went to the College of Arts and Sciences, kind of general thing. I'd been a very good student, so I bypassed a lot of preliminary courses and jumped right into some, you know, almost like junior, senior year courses in English and stuff, which was like, you know, in the ancient English language and learning to speak the language of Beowulf and Dr. Birdsall. I loved her to death, but I didn't have a clue. But my paper was about the Christianity in Beowulf.
know, a little dumb, but okay.
Well, no, but so what were you thinking?
I was thinking that, well, in the 50s, you know, let's face it, what would women think about? Well, teaching nursing, interior decoration.
Right.
I loved art. I had always drawn and painted and done all that sort of stuff on the side. So, oh, maybe, but so elementary education seemed like a great fit.
Right.
And I could teach, you know. Well, you know, a few classes at 8 a.m. in the morning of being taught rhythmic analysis by people who didn't have a lot of rhythm. You know, it was like, okay. So I moved around a lot through the colleges, but I ended up in art, and because I was an okay artist, but and not particularly brilliant artist at all. And then I ended up with in art history, which is my degree is in art history, but I've got minors in English, and in dance, and in drama.
How did that happen?
Taking a lot of classes and doing an extra semester. I was in college four.
Okay, so what made you take drama?
Well, we'll stay with the dance program.
Okay.
What made me take that is my fear of water. Because at the University of Maryland, you had to take four semesters of physical ed. It was a requirement. You could not get out of it.
Right.
And my first semester, I took kind of a combination thing where you did archery and gymnastics and stuff like that.
Right.
But I knew one
it was
of the
coming.
Yes. One of the semesters was going to be swimming, and I was terrified of that. But so my second semester, I took modern dance. And now I go from my ballet back into physical expression that is beyond the ballet. The modern dance company at the university was doing this piece in combination with the symphony and the drama department. It was a combination of choral work, acting work, and dance work, and symphonic work. And so they needed extra people, and they asked me to join. And I did, and I did well with that. And then, so by the end of the semester, they asked me to join the company. And I said, okay, I'll do that if you'll get me out of swimming.
Swimming.
I figured I'd do anything to get out of swimming.
Well, and this was not a terrible thing to
no,
do.
Right? No, no.
Because it's going to be a win-win for you.
Oh, and the class to somebody beating a drum who actually had rhythm. You know, it was wonderful. And so over the course of the next year or so, I got into the theater department by way of dancing in a production of Showboat there, and then I had to sing in that a little bit too, do all of this, and that introduced me to the theater department. So then I wanted to take acting classes because I was fascinated with that.
And in the meanwhile, you're still an elementary education major?
For a while, and then I switched over to the arts, and I said, oh God, what can I do? Okay, well, I'll do the art department, okay, because to get a degree in dance, you had to take kinesiology, which is like beyond my job description in terms of science and math. So, and it's, I love science in some regards, but at the same time, it just wasn't me. So, there I am, getting my way into the modern dance department, led me into theater, which led me to choreography, which was bringing together a lot of things, and also working with the dance company, I designed a couple of sets and some costumes, because we were obviously a small group, and it was really interesting. And then, so I'm in drawing classes and things and doing well, but your senior year of the art department at the University of Maryland, they would give you an atelier, which is your own little studio, and I'm going, what am I going to do with that? I'm not inspired to fine art, I mean, in terms of what I want to say. Dorothy Madden was the first doctorate of dance in the United States. She got her doctorate from a piece, a concert piece of like, I think it's seven individual dance pieces that make this evening. And she says, I want you to do this piece because you're the actress. And that was the first time someone had really said that to me. It was a true story of a woman who went mad and was trying to tear down the walls of her house because she was hearing voices. It was this whole piece about her going crazy. And so...
So it required not only a dancer, but an actor.
An actor. And that was the first time that stuff started to come together.
That somebody told you
that and encouraged me and gave me something to do. The piece was just stunning. I can still remember aspects of it as I stand, you know, on half toe just swaying in the wind like a wind chime, and you would hear this Gregorian chant that would come over, and it was a sense of having to know when it was coming to be able to do the move where she's hearing that, you know? And it was, and then there's two other dancers behind this beautiful woven fishnetty stuff that are like the voices, and this, it was just, it was amazing, and an amazing piece, and amazing to do it, and to feel that power of communication on a stage. But, and in acting classes too, and we have teachers who taught Stanislavski, and you're learning about this, so you're starting to put those pieces together.
So you're having acting classes?
Yes, I'm taking the acting classes, and because I was fascinated by it. I don't know whether at that point I thought of being an actor, or I thought that it was going to teach me more, it was going to give me more juice for the dance, you know, and also for the choreography. Because to be able, I understood music, I could read scores, you know, and but to understand what the characters, because as a choreographer, you have to create all of the characters in a sense, because you're going to tell them how to move.
Right.
You're going to come up with the movements for this particular character, or that, or the group. And so that was all, it was all kind of coming together that way.
Yeah, it was coalescing, even though it wasn't intentional.
Not yet, exactly. It wasn't something that... But also while I was at the university, one of the grad students was the tent tech out at a place called the Shady Grove Music Fair, which was one of these big summer stock tents that, you know, would hold like a 4,000 people or something, mm-hmm. 2,000 people, and, you know, and they would have the stars come in, and it was in the round, and they would do musicals, predominantly. She got me a job for the summer as a dresser and also as a prop person. And so that was the first time now I'm seeing real professionals work, and I could sit in the back for rehearsals and to see this wonderful dancer working on the Dream Ballet in Oklahoma, you know, and I can still see her out on that stage and see those, it formulates something in you. I mean, I had to go buy white sneakers and white socks because they all rehearsed in these little white Mary Jane sneakers, you know, the little tiny little kids, and everybody was dancing in kids in those days, and I had to go get those and do that, and it started to all come together that I wanted to go to New York. I think it was the summer after my senior year at my church. There was a little theater group that had formed in the community, and we were going to put on a show. And there, I met another gal who was moving to New York. She was already had an apartment, and so we stayed in touch, and so, you know, one semester later, she said, yeah, why don't you come and share my studio? So I moved to New York and shared the studio for a while.
So at this point, have you said to yourself, I'm going to be the dancer, a choreographer,
I
an
wanted
actor?
To be, I wanted to be a choreographer, I think. So.
Did you ever tell your dad?
My parents being the people that they are, I think they thought I was a little naive, but okay. But everybody's always scared of New York at first. But, you know, you learn how to be very adaptable. And I was, when I look back, I had a set of principles in my mind that I was not going to waver from. Eye on the prize. I wanted success in the theater. Was I defining that as a choreographer? Well, maybe I would get to that. But first, I had to get in a Broadway show. And so that's when I found out that now they're changing from dancing, singing courses to everybody doing all of it. And the guy sends me out on stage because they had said, we have to sing. I said, sing, I don't know a song. And the guy said, you know Happy Birthday, right? Sing Happy Birthday. I'm like, okay. Well, he put it obviously
in a key
that was like the belty alto key. So instead of going on going, Happy Birthday, I went, Happy Birthday. I scared myself, you know. And then I remember Ona White, I made it down, and this was like, I'm not union, so this is the non-union tryouts, auditions, and I make it that cut, and she says, you, in the red ribbon, learn a song.
Wow.
Yes, ma'am. I learned, I think, if my friends could see me now, I made it. And I remember Bea Arthur was going to be the star of the show, and she's kind of tall as a teacher, and it was about college, so we were going to be college students. Mm-hmm. So Ona White says to me, she says, how tall are you? And I kind of look to the right and to the left, and I was like seeing the parts in everybody's hair, and I'm not, in those days I was, guess maybe 5'6" or 5'7" was
considered tall. But you were taller than everybody?
But I was taller. Would you believe 5'2"? I seriously said that, and she said no, but thank you so much. You know, and I cried and cried at home, and I didn't get the show.
You mean because you didn't get it?
Yeah. And then you just keep going, and the next thing you know, you do have a job. It was an early Rodgers and Hart show, and I'd never been revived. And a season up at the Goodspeed was being done by the people who had produced Man of La Mancha. And my mother was so, she said, well, everything's fine, because the pianist in the pit was the guy from the Arthur Godfrey show. So, hey, everything's okay. And it's in this lovely, lovely place on the Connecticut River. Hey, what's so bad about showbiz? No. Second job was the Elmwood Casino up in Canada between the two railroad tracks outside of Detroit, dancing in a nightclub line. No, you didn't let them see that.
Okay, so you started to get work.
Yes. Those first auditions had been maybe in the early spring, and so by the early summer, I booked this job at the Goodspeed, which got me my equity card.
Really? That was pretty fast.
It was. It was incredibly fast.
Yes.
And by that time, I had started dancing at the Luigi Studio. In fact, they told us, some of us, about that audition to go to. It was a kind of an all-inclusive, almost like a little theater training place. They had a good, Claude Garvey played, that was a coach, and Nipsey Russell's conductor.
Oh, my.
But he coached people, you know. Mm-hmm. God, what a great guy. You know, but he was the one who got me to sing. He says, you have to sing it your own way, you know, which didn't necessarily bode so well for the future in musical theater sometimes, because composer wanted it sung his way.
His way, absolutely. You know? Right.
But he taught me a lot about jazz and interpretation. It was a wonderful education.
But so far, you're getting basically singer-dancer stuff.
Yes.
Right?
And that's basically, in musical theater, that's kind of what my type is going to get, because I basically had the mezzo-alto voice, the belter, quote-unquote. And so unless you move into the really serious principal roles like Rose and Gypsy, which was older than me, the younger roles, I'm going to be the soubrette.
Right.
I'm the sidekick. Right. Not only are you singing the brassy songs and you're, you know, but you're also carrying some of the comedy element,
right,
too.
Right.
And
you could dance.
And dancing, because
right,
a lot of that,
that's
all
right,
pulled together in all of those characters.
Right. So inadvertently, mm-hmm, you had all of the things that you were going to need to get the work you were going to get at the beginning of your career. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And without plan,
right,
really.
Right.
Right.
It's funny. It's funny that you say that. God, you're just... I love your perceptions and how you put it together, because in a weird way, I've never planned.
No.
I spent some time with Zen Buddhism, and I think that there's this thing of just go with the flow,
exactly,
kind of thing.
Exactly.
And you're going down the road, and because you don't want to miss what's on either side, and you don't know what is going to catch your attention, because do we decide, sometimes, how do you decide when you're, I don't know, 12 years old, oh, I have to do this? Maybe if you're a gymnast or something, you have to decide then, but you know. But for a lot of other life, you don't know where those roads are going to go.
No, but what it seems to me is that whether you identified as a Buddhist, you are actually kind of a Buddhist.
Yeah.
And it is this idea that one can trust one's instincts.
You
know, this feels right, okay, good. That's, this feels right, and this doesn't feel so good, right, like that. And that's what it seems like you were doing, even from the beginning, knowing tap wasn't for you. It was too rigid. It was too controlled.
Yeah.
But modern dance was, from the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes. Thank you. That's really sweet. It's nice to put it that way. It helps me, you know, because it is. It is your instincts. And sometimes you do make mistakes.
Yeah.
And I've never minded, in some ways, some of the mistakes that you make, because how else do you learn anything?
Well, and when you found yourself in something that didn't actually fit, you didn't stay there that long. And so when you come to work, you have really all the pieces that you need to do the kind of work that was going to be open to you, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Exactly. And because of my looks, I could also get commercials for TV. And also back in those days, they had things called industrial shows. I got some of the best training I ever got was working in industrial shows.
You know, you're a wonderful actor. Is that it? That's all the training you had?
I went into a couple of acting classes in New York, and I didn't like them because it seemed that they were all very self-indulgent and kind of almost encouraging you not to go out and audition until you're ready.
Well, and we'll tell you when.
Yeah, sorry, I got to pay the rent.
Yeah, right.
So I'll go out and audition for, you know, whatever will keep me going. My first Broadway show was The Magic Show, and there was this gentleman in that, Sam Schacht, God bless him, and Sam was from the Actors Studio.
Mm-hmm. But he's doing this kind of crazy part in The Magic Show. He's not really a singer, but it was a part that required a really good actor, comedian, could handle this stuff.
He was wonderful, and I felt in trouble with what I was doing and not understanding stuff so well. And I literally asked him, I said, would you teach me about acting? He was a natural teacher. And so he started coaching me, and I learned so much from him, which I'm happy to say that led him into doing more teaching. But I was lucky to have him to myself for quite a while. Wow. You know, and I could bring him in when I was doing shows. I'd get him tickets. He would watch and take notes, and then we'd do coaching after that. If he couldn't come, my friend Kay, who was a wonderful actress herself, and I'd call her.
Well, you know, you're making a really interesting point, I think, and that is that one can always be better.
The one thing that is the beauty of, I think, all of the arts is that you are always evolving. Mm-hmm. You are always growing. It's not an end product. You're really growing inside yourself, in parts of your intellect, maybe, but also in your heart and your soul and your evolution of how you're looking at the world, which I think is maybe unique to, in some ways, to the arts.
Do you think that's, to some extent, the result of the parts that you take?
Yes, I think so, because in this business, you're not always playing perfect people. In fact, the most interesting characters that you get to play are the imperfect people. And sometimes that imperfection is not always something that you want to aspire to. But sometimes when people do bad things, they're not necessarily starting out to do bad things, but they have a reason for what they do. Everybody has a reason for what they do, so you have to look at the reason. So when you start looking at a reason why somebody behaves the way they do, then you look in yourself and you go like, I could understand that reasoning. Not that I think about that I would do what that person did, but I can understand the impetus where it comes from.
Yes.
I'm sure we can all understand the impetus at times to be so hurt or angry or afraid.
Yes.
That we could kill someone.
Yes.
I mean, that's, you know, really extreme. When it's whether we don't do it, but you have to, if you're going to play someone who has done something terrible, you have to understand where it comes from. I did the musical Little Women, and I played Aunt March, who is just an arrogant, vicious B-I-T-C-H in many regards. Mm-hmm. When I saw it on Broadway, and I said, there's an actress who's, she's quite lovely, but she doesn't want to be perceived of.
Yes.
As
what she needs to be perceived of.
Exactly. And therefore, she doesn't have the wonderful resolution that is there in the play that allows her to have, for the audience to see that there is this heart inside her. And it's like, Pride and Prejudice, and Mr. Darcy's aunt, who is just seems so vicious and vile, and all of that. And then at the end, we see her really understanding not only her own nephew, but this woman that he's marrying and approving of it. And you just, she breaks your heart, in a sense.
Yeah.
And that was Aunt March. And but you had to go to the ugly side, and she had to be this unrelenting woman who, you know, and cold in a sense, and funny because of her eccentricities, but at heart she was going, oh God, please. But then at the end, she is the one who is, in a sense, the redeeming character for Joe. But that's actors, a lot of actors are afraid to be the bad guy.
Yeah, or unattractive in some way.
Yes, exactly. And that's, I think, one of the things that I'm not afraid of. I'm not afraid to, you know, one of my girlfriends is an actress, says, my God, you will go into auditions looking like awful. And I said, yeah, because that's the character. I auditioned for Ma Joad. This is not going to be an attractive woman.
No.
And sometimes, you know, I have to go against the perception that people have of me of being attractive. And I like to feel like I'm attractive in my everyday life. But on stage, I don't need to. No, it might not. If it's necessary, if that's what's part of the character, okay, well, you can doll me up. But if it's not necessary, I want to be that macho who is, you know, who looks like hell.
Yeah.
Because she's been through hell.
Right, right.
You know, and so which means, you know, coming in looking really terrible.
Yeah.
And I realized going through some old resumes, most of the plays that I've done, I've basically done since 2000. And before that, it was more musical. I did make one major decision in my life. I realized probably 20 years ago that I was going to have to make a transition to plays because there weren't that many older women in musicals. And then, of course, the star thing started to happen, where even sometimes in regional theaters, you'll get ousted for a character because of a, as my agent would say, if somebody's going to sell 10 more tickets, you know, they're in, you're out, even if they can barely do anything.
What did you do?
I talked to my agents about it, and I said, I really, really, really think that down the line, I'm going to want to move into plays. And a lot of the musicals that I have done have been pieces that require more than just sort of the frivolity of being the silly soubrette. And I think of pieces like Getting My Act Together and Taking It on the Road, and A, My Name is Alice, and things like that where you really have to dig into stuff about yourself, about women, you know, about what's happening in the political world. And I like the conversations that you get to have in those situations, and I like being, you know, having to use my mind and my thoughts about the world and life and people, rather than just, you know, oh, I can sing this note, you know, oh, I can hit this note, you know, it's more than that. And so as I started doing little off-Broadway things and stuff, and, you know, I was loving the conversations and the table work and how everybody talks around and how everybody, even from the smallest part, is included in the conversation. In musicals, there's kind of a hierarchy. You got your stars, right, your leads, right, then you have the chorus. And because they're almost two separate unions,
right,
in a way, because of contracts, we're saying union, but
yeah,
two,
right,
different contracts, there's sort of a division. You know,
yeah,
and I'm this like...
A hierarchy.
Yes. But in plays, you could have a few lines in one scene, and you're at the table.
Yes.
And your contribution, you can participate. You can... Maybe you're not going to talk as much as the leading character, because you don't have as much to talk about, but you can participate in the overall conversation. And that egalitarianism,
yeah,
of that where we're all one, really appeals to me. And if it's not there, I don't, then there's something wrong. You know, and sometimes maybe in some director might not be, you know, could be different. But I love that part of the process and where you get to know about who these people really are and where they are and at what period of history are they in and what's going on around them, you know, and go to, oh my God, August Osage County, down at the alley. I mean, they gave us, I mean, the handbook of material they gave us to read from the dramaturg department, good Lord, it was like an encyclopedia. And it was wonderful. Like the history of the playwright, and why he would write it, because he's writing very much about his own background, as is Shanley. I mean, I printed out a whole bunch of stuff for myself, because, I mean, I love research, I guess, from the art history. Boom, I'm on the computer, and it's like wonderful interviews with him and writings by Shanley about Mullingar. And
talk a little bit about the play.
Well, it took him about 20 years to write it, he says.
Really?
Yes, he was born Irish American. I guess when his father was more elderly, wanted to go back to the ancestral home, and Shanley went with him. And it was the first time meeting so many of his Irish relatives, and it just blew him away.
And how old was he?
I think probably he was, I'm going to say was probably in his 30s or 40s.
Wow.
Yeah, something like that would make sense. And because I think he's in his 60s now. And he suddenly said, it talked about how it was all of a sudden this recognition.
Yes, this is who I am. This is where
this
I come
is,
from.
Yes, and the humor, the humor about mortality, the aggressiveness, and he talks about it. Oh my God! It was the house. They barely had any light. It was like he had to ask somebody to put a light on because they were like in the dark yelling at each other. They talk over each other and this whole kind of thing and this sort of energy, you know, and yet there's all of this kind of, in a sense, unconditional love. They hold grudges like crazy. You know, nobody forgets anything in Ireland. You know, it could be for 40 years. And I remember that they did such and such, you know. And a lot of these characters are really sort of out of his own family. I look at the play as a just one big poem. It is a poem, and it is like an homage or an ode to his family and to his background and to his coming in touch with his real Irish ancestral history and his real Irish self.
Yes.
And it's so beautiful, and it, to me, it's about like very unconventional and love and unconditional love.
Yes.
And that how people can somehow think that they're not right, but they're okay. It doesn't matter.
That's right.
We all have those things, and some of us may be more extreme than others, and some of us hide things more than others.
Well, but that point that people who feel that they are different or don't see others as being like them can hide.
Yeah.
You know, when in fact, how can you be anything that other human beings aren't?
Yeah.
I mean, really, yeah. You can't, there's yeah. really not an option. If you are it,
yeah,
it's a human quality.
Yeah.
But we don't necessarily know that. And we're very rigid about what is right and wrong and what is good and bad. And so somebody right. who doesn't feel identified with that, right?
Right.
So this play makes that the point that it's all okay.
Yeah.
It's all okay.
That love, you know, that old phrase, you know, love conquers all.
Yes.
And it really does. And who is going to decide what's right and wrong about who we love or how we love? And love takes on the concept of respecting others and respecting yourself, because if you love yourself, then that allows you to love someone else, and you have to respect yourself and other people and give people some free rein. My thing is, I'm not going to invite everybody over for dinner, but that doesn't mean I don't love them.
Right.
You know, and hey, God bless you. You know, have a wonderful life.
That one can love without feeling compelled to
have everybody over for dinner.
Right.
And it just, and I do think that there's so much in it. What makes me happy to be doing this play, why I wanted to do it, was that there was just something just screaming at me about that it is something that maybe will open up hearts. That will, in a very, literally, hour and a half, takes everybody on their own personal journey, I think.
Yes.
You know, it's, and there's all kinds of the four of us, there's only four characters, but we're very recognizable to be a lot of different people to a lot of different people. Do you know what I mean? We can be grandmothers or mothers or daughters or sisters or brothers or uncles, husbands, you know, bosses, whatever.
Right.
All of those, all of the four of us can represent to a lot of different people in the audience different parts of their lives.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be necessarily the same story, but it's that representative. And sometimes if it can give you some sort of enlightenment or whatever, it's wonderful. And you know, it's very important that we make connections, and I think that that's what I loved about the theater, and why I wanted to move, I guess, instinctively, into a time where I was using my voice to speak words,
yeah.
and to be able to move, but I felt that sometimes just doing the movement, you know, I wanted more, and I'm pushing forward also in my life because I want I like to write.
I was just going to ask that. You know, are you writing?
Yeah, I have been writing on and off for years, and one of the things about having our Historic House Museum is I get to write a lot, you know, and I'm writing things like National Register applications, even though I get it gets tweaked by a historian, but I had to learn how to write historical, you know, for the historical people.
So are you writing pieces to be done in the...
I have a project in mind that I've been toying around with for years. My husband and I talk about the fact of, like, how do we want to orchestrate our lives now, and sometimes you just get too much going on and you don't need all of it.
Oh.
So we're trying to downsize our life as, you know, and kind of be a little more focused on some things, and because I, you know, and like... Because we always ask ourselves the question, okay, if you had all the time in the world, what would you want to do? You know, and part of it is, I say, I really would like to concentrate on this little writing project that I have, you know. And I know I can't do it by myself. I'm going to have help because I don't consider myself, you know, a playwright or anything like that. But it would be it's a one-woman piece, but maybe it's going to be a story. Maybe it's going to be an essay. I don't know. A long essay, it's not going to be a novel or anything like that. But I think I would want it to be a performance piece. I think at this point, that's what I'm working on. So.
And when it feels right to do, that's what you'll do because that's what you do.
Yeah, and if it's just something that I'm always playing around with, that's okay also, because I certainly have other outlets where I don't work as much as I used to. I'm blessed by a pretty decent pension and a pretty decent social security, and I have my socialized medicine, thank you very much, that I'm so happy about, I don't have to, you know, be struggling to pay, even with our union giving us pension and health, but you would have to work up for health credits, and I watched our health care system just, oh my God, get so expensive. Because I could self-pay if I didn't have enough credits. And what I would have to pay a month, I'm going,
I know.
Holy crap. Right. You know, and so I really feel, you know, the burden has been lifted. I don't have to do anything I don't want to do.
I was just going to say you can choose.
Yes, and my agent's fabulous about it. He said, you don't want to do it, then I don't want to do it, you know. Who cares? And he says, I'll keep submitting you for everything.
And then you'll choose.
And I'll choose, and sometimes I might choose, and they don't choose me. You know, it's kind of, you know, which is the way it goes, but that's fine too. So.
Well, I'm really glad they chose you.
Well, thank you.
You're
thank
wonderful you. In it. It's not the biggest role, but it's really pivotal.
She is. Yeah. And she's grown a lot since we first opened. It was a difficult birth. She isn't an easy character.
No.
You know, at all. And get trying to set the right tone with her, because there's things that the playwright is expecting of this character that is given the character to do.
Can you say?
Yeah. First of all, we're setting up this, as the story is going to evolve, we're setting up a narrative. You know, there's a lot of information that comes out in that very first scene.
Yes.
You know, and it has to be clear. And it has to be spoken, not only spoken clearly, but it, you know, it's gotta stick in people's minds so that they can...
Because they're going to need it later.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
But at the same time, you're doing that. It's not, you're not giving a lecture.
No.
You know,
right.
You have to create the atmosphere. You have to create where we are. We have to create who is this old woman.
Right.
And he doesn't help because he really sort of doesn't introduce Aoife as the widow. I mean, it takes us...
No, it comes, you have to get that.
Yes, right. Yes, exactly. And so, and he's also expecting... I think that there's a tone of humor that is set between the character, between Tony and Aoife in the first scene that we're going to need also as the play goes on. Mm-hmm. And not only for the audience to understand they can laugh, and for to understand that they're going to be laughing at some very odd things.
That's right.
You know, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So there's those tasks within the fact of sort of shaping this character. You know, and what I think about her, and that goes back to all those women that I knew as a child even, and my mother and some of my mother's friends, and some of those Southern women who have just done me in such good stead as I just, because someone said, when I my first Daisy, I was asked one time, you know, how did you find her character or whatever? And I said, I channeled my mother and her best friend, Lovey. You know? And then put in together with, I have many Jewish friends, so I was able to take so much of my understanding of Judaism from my friends and going to their various events and you know, things, to put that into Daisy, into that context
To incorporate all those pieces.
Right, and my understanding of the history of race relations in this country, which I have followed since I was a kid.
Right.
And that's basically so much of what Driving Miss Daisy is about. It's true. In an hour and a half, she goes from 74 to 97, and we track a major part of our evolution in race relations in a way that I just think is stunning.
Yes.
You know, I've done it 3 times, and I hope I get to do it at least 3 times more, you know, because I think it's one of the most powerful pieces. You know, and that's why something like Mullingar, I hope we get to do Mullingar again.
Can you not do them in your museum?
No. Our museum is it's a log plank house. Probably, as I say, it's a house that most of us came from. If we had descendants who were living in this country before, say, 1900, this is probably a kind of a house that they may have lived in, at least the size of it, one down, one up. It is made by hand. It was built sometime around 1800, and we're just getting, when it was originally built, it was built to have a wooden chimney, which is also stunning to people to realize that most of the houses and so much of this country had wooden chimneys. And we're just getting the drawings and things. We're just getting ready. That's my next writing project is coming up, because we've got to put in for the application for the Department of Historic Resources in Virginia to get approval for what we're doing. But it's like this, it's this weird living building, because it's put together on the corners with these joints, mm-hmm. and these joints has never been taken apart. It's been moved twice, and ordinarily the National Register would never register a house that's been moved once, let alone twice, except they're doing that with some of the Freedmen's and African-American housing issues of the past. But they listed us, like, in a heartbeat. But we have never been taken apart, and sometimes when you're standing inside these logs, you can feel all of that history that has gone on before, and all the lives and deaths and things that have happened. And it is seeing this evolution of how we started as a nation. The regular people, not the rich people.
Yeah, right.
This is like where my family came from.
Right.
Both sides of my family, we're like from the 1600s. So, and that's where they came from. They weren't wealthy people, and they struggled and up through things. And as so many, and it's like the heart of our nation and how we built our nation. And I love it when kids come who have their heads buried in their cell phones, and for some weird reason, they put their cell phone, they're looking around, and they love to go up in the garret and see where the kids would live, you know, and the thoughts, and then you ask them, why is this window here over the staircase going upstairs? Why is that window there? And they can't figure it out. And I said, well, look around. I mean, do you think they had electricity in those days and electric lights? No. And I said, so maybe you put a window over a staircase so you can get a little bit of light? Even on a moonlit night, the moon comes in through that and lights that staircase, and I can get up without turning the lights on. You know, and it's this to see the kids, and it's like amazing. And then you bring out the old toys, the hoops that you push, and all of this stuff, and they're just transfixed, and they get obsessive about doing cup and ball. You know,
yeah,
and these are kids.
You change their lives.
You know, and it's so we want to do more projects like that. And I do and I do want to do a thing where with a costume parade of, because we've collected a lot of historical clothing. I've been in love with that for years too, because, you know, just fashion of old people, old time these. And I had this idea that maybe we can do some kind of a tea for mothers and daughters, or for everybody, I don't know, and then have the women, the dummies with the dresses and things, but had some of my younger kids in the area, docents, helpers and stuff, the Girl Scouts or something, come and talk about who that person is and what their life would have been like at that time, you know.
And, well, so it's really lovely, and I just keep thinking that you could theoretically do some kind of theater piece.
Yeah, I think we could. We would have to, we just can't fit many people in there. But we could do something that could be outside also. We have land, it could be something, you know, I know in New York they have done some wonderful play pieces where you follow the play along room
yes,
to room,
right,
like
right.
At the Armory once, there was
yeah, I've seen a couple
like
of them.
Like on-site somebody's stuff.
Right, and you wander around,
yeah.
Right, and these people are doing this here, and these people are doing this there.
So you
right.
could take people in groups, so you got the inside scene going on, and then you move outside, there's an outside scene, you know, and everything. And actually, we did see it at some kind of place in the Hudson Valley once where they used different pieces, different parts of this sort of estate. They moved everybody. The one at the Armory, it was almost this ongoing
yes,
thing.
I've been at that too,
yeah.
Where you can go wherever you want, and you're in a different room with different scenes,
things,
right?
And then you kind of
right.
come to put it together,
right,
and it's
right,
almost
right,
like
right.
the old, the Mr. Mustard in the live doctor, Colonel Mustard in the library, or whatever, you know. So,
okay, wait. I have this one other question,
okay.
And it is, you know, having given really essentially a life to this work,
mm-hmm.
is there anything you would say about what that's like?
It's been absolutely... I guess what would be a word that would say, would, because you can't say, because it's not all wonderful. It's been difficult at times, but I think it is, I have felt incredibly blessed to have been able to do that.
Yeah.
To have the experiences that I've had, to have met and been around the people. Years ago when I was getting my act together, taking it on the road, you know, I told my mother, she was still alive then, you know, I said, oh my gosh, I mean, I could be hit by a car tomorrow and I would feel like I have, you know, that I have done what I think I'm supposed to do in my life, you know, in terms of communicating with people and all of that, and it would be okay, I would have no regrets. And I feel the same way today, I have no regrets. I think I've had an absolutely wonderful career. I'm certainly far from being a star, but it's not something that I don't think I ever really aspired to, because I think it would be limiting. You know, I like the fact that I can live my life and I can do work and I can change the concept of that work however I want to. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
You know, and I don't have to, and it doesn't matter as much what people write about me in the newspapers or whatever. Do you know what I mean? And so you're sort of free to just be and enjoy. It's been a wonderful life on some, you know, ups and downs, but then that makes things interesting. You know,
it's a great place to stop.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Louisa.
Oh, thank
my
you.
God.
So Louisa says, if I got hit by a car tomorrow, I would have no regrets. I would know that I had lived the life I was meant to live, the life I was supposed to live. I had done what I was supposed to do. I had been the person I really am. So I'm wondering, as you are listening to Louisa and you hear the passion and commitment in her voice, are you thinking, am I living the life I was meant to live? Can I say that I have no regrets? That I have been the person I was meant to be? Well, if you can't say that, if you feel that there are things that you wish you would have done, if there are behaviors you wish you would have been able to express, if there are ways of being which you yearn for or are jealous of in other people, please believe me that it may not be too late to recover what you may have had to lose, what you may have hidden or denied in order to get through your childhood. And of course, that's the work of psychotherapy. And if you have questions about psychotherapy and how it works and how it helps you recover what you may have lost, please go to my website, thelynshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Thelynshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E-S-H-O-W. Up there you can get a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, and it is just what it says. It talks about why you can't do what you want to do when you want to. You can even listen to the first chapter. I have it up there on audio. You can click on the email tab and ask me any questions. I'll be happy to get your question and happy to answer you. You can listen to all my shows in podcast form. You can listen to them right up there, or you can download them. You can listen to all the interviews I've ever done. As I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, you can click on the category tab and ask for musicians or playwrights or dancers or actors or fine artists and see who you might want to listen to. So, as always, I hope that you got something that you can use from this show, something that you didn't know that you know now, something that inspired you, something that tickled you, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. On singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't.